this is Hugh Beard. I'm your moderator for this evening's discussion. I'm here with State Senator Jay Costin. We want to welcome you to this live telephone town hall. If you have a question for Senator Costa at any point this evening, press star 3 on your phone's keypad. Again, if you have a question for Senator Costa about anything this evening, press star 3 on your phone's keypad. And I'd like to welcome Senator Jay Costa.
Thank you very much, Hugh, and I want to take a moment to thank all of the folks who are participating in this evening's telephone town hall. I really want to get to some of the questions that folks want to ask us, and but just before I do that, I just want to give folks an update on what things are going on and transpiring up here in Harrisburg. Earlier today, Governor Wolf proposed his 2017-2018 fiscal year budget. Some of the highlights that are part of that budget conversation relate specifically to the significant structural deficit that we have. We're facing about a $3 billion structural deficit going into next year. We're ending this year probably close to $700 million short of where we projected back on June 30th when we enacted the 16-17 budget. To try to address this, the governor has come up with what I think a very innovative and thoughtful proposal that reduces spending by $2 billion. He recognizes, and I really agree, that we have to take steps unlike we've taken before to really streamline some of the things that we're able to do and look at a way to try to close that structural deficit. So by reducing this funding, reducing the expenditures by $2 billion, that's an appropriate step. At the same time, recognizing that he wants to make certain that we continue some of the initiatives that he believes in and that we as Senate Democrats believe in, we'll continue to make investments in education, specifically in K-12, but also in the special education area, $25 million, and I believe $75 million into early learning programs. As I said before, the most significant investments that we make and the best investments we make in state government. I will say also that the governor is looking to generate some additional revenue, again, specifically looking to the Marcellus Shale community to be part of our solution with respect to the revenue side of the equation to help close that gap that I referenced. So a number of ideas have been circulated. One most significant idea is the creation of a new agency, the Department of Health and Human Services. What we would have is we would reduce and eliminate the four existing agencies and basically merge them into one larger agency that would be responsible for delivering the collective services of the other four agencies and be able to do it in a more cost-effective and a cost-efficient manner without impacting and, in fact, enhancing the services that would be provided. So that's something that we're interested to work forward with. But at the end of the day, we're going to work with the governor's office and others to pursue an appropriate budget. But for Senate Democrats, there are a couple priorities that we're going to continue to talk about during this period of time. We continue to believe that one of the central issues to the people of Pennsylvania is how we grow jobs and how we make investments to be able to help create jobs and retain jobs here in this Commonwealth. That will continue to be a focus that we talk about, and the governor talked a little bit about that in terms of his plans to grow jobs. We've grown about 82,000 jobs in Pennsylvania since 15 when the governor came in office, and we need to continue that trend. It's a trend in a positive direction, but we have to be able to do that with investments and targeted investments and things that work. And I will tell you, folks, that programs that don't work won't be getting resources. Folks who receive resources and grants and tax credits and the like that didn't meet their obligation, we'll be looking to claw back those resources to make certain that as we go forward, we can reuse those dollars and investments into our communities. Finally, one of the areas that Senate Democrats are talking about and we will continue to talk about is property tax relief. We have to figure out a way to provide property tax relief, reduction, or elimination, whatever the case may be, over the course of the next several months. We have proposed, again, Senate legislation that would allow for a rebate to folks of $1,900 of their school property taxes, and we believe that's one of the solutions that we need to talk about. So what we have done is we asked the governor to give us a special session on property tax so that we can vet a variety of proposals and heighten the understanding and heighten the awareness of this very, very important issue. So those are some of the things that we have out there that we're talking about. And before we move on to questions, I wanted to just touch base because a number of folks have already sent us questions via email or Twitter or text. One of them relates specifically to property taxes, I've mentioned in the latter part of my conversation, specifically with regard to Woodland Hills. Woodland Hills school taxes are proposed to be increased, I think, 14% this year. I believe that there's other concerns going forward. The governor and his budget is going to provide $100 million additionally to school districts and the other ones I mentioned, special ed. At the end of the day, my expectation and hope is that that additional resources will work to drive down the proposed increase that would take place in the Woodland Hills School District. But at the end of the day, we still have work to do to try to restore the level of funding to our schools to allow them to be able to operate in an appropriate and efficient manner and educate our kids in a proper environment as we go forward. So we will pay close attention to not only Woodland Hills, but all the school districts in our district and across our southwestern part of the state to make sure that we recognize the impact that these tax increases are having on our seniors. There are senior programs that we participate in already, and we need to expand some of those. And one of the things that we're working on is looking at the property tax and rent rebate program to grow that program as well. Another area, I'm sorry.
Senator, before we move on to another one of the submitted questions, just a reminder for those that have joined us, if you want to ask Senator Costa a question, you can press *3 on your phone's keypad. That's *3 if you'd like to get in. We'll get you screened and up and running. Senator, I know we have a number of folks that are waiting to talk to you. We're going to get them through the screening process, but let's go back to another submitted question.
So just a couple other questions. In light of activities up here in Harrisburg, we received a number of calls on the issue of women's health care and women's health decisions. We are going to be experiencing tomorrow in the Senate, on the Senate floor, Senate Bill 3. Senate Bill 3 relates to the issue of reducing the time period with respect to when it would be permitted to have an abortion from 24 weeks down to 20 weeks. It's caused a lot of concern with a lot of folks, and we've heard from a number of people along those lines. It's my intention to not support the legislation, and a number of folks have addressed the concerns that we've talked about. But that is one of the issues that has been percolating here in Harrisburg, part of the November timeframe when we are here before legislatively. And again, this is one of the very first things that our Republican colleagues are rolling out. So it's unfortunate that that's going to be the case, but we'll be dealing with that along those lines. One other question on the area of health care relates to the Affordable Care Act repeal. I'm one of those folks that supports and recognizing the tremendous benefits that the Affordable Care Act has brought to not only Pennsylvania, but to this country. When I look at what's been done here in Pennsylvania, I look and I see the Medicaid expansion program. 700,000 individuals today have a level of health care coverage that they did not have before. These are working individuals, folks who are making anywhere from for an individual to maybe $30,000, $32,000 a year. They get a modest level of health care, but again, these are working folks. You take away the Affordable Care Act, you strip those folks of their resources, of health care benefits. To me, that would be wrong. But more importantly, some of the areas that we've got grave concern about relate to the issue of the some of the other provisions of the Affordable Care Act. Very quickly, running through those, the cap on lifetime benefits. Before the Affordable Care Act, insurance companies would place a cap on the total dollar amount that you were able to receive from the insurance company. That's been removed. Folks, in today's environment, if you end up with one catastrophic event, you can wipe out your health care coverage in one catastrophic event and be stuck for the rest of your life without any additional health care. With respect to the pre-existing condition, that's not permitted to determine your premium levels based upon a pre-existing condition, or even if you can get insurance with a pre-existing condition. Those provisions are gone. Changes to the donut hole on prescription drugs would be gone. Having your child stay on your benefit package up to age 26, those things will be gone. We have to make certain we work hard to preserve some of those things through this whole process, and we also got to look at the impact that it means to Pennsylvania. But to think that 700,000 folks would not have the level of health care in Pennsylvania disturbs me, particularly as it relates to the behavioral health side. And a large part of that are children. Children with them, over 100,000 kids who are on part of that program now would be shifted off of that program and moved over and back into the CHIP program, which doesn't provide the same level of benefits to the children who are being served. So there are a number of concerns we have along those lines, and we're going to continue to fight to be able to preserve that at the federal level as well. So folks have asked me about, what do we do with the president, President Trump? I wish I could tell you that I have no input at the federal level to try to address some of the things that are being done there. But I can say to you that I think that we all got to be cognizant of some of the changes that are coming to Washington and recognize the impact that they're having on Pennsylvania, both fiscally but also in terms of socially, in terms of how we react and how we deal things with Pennsylvania. I've got major concerns. I mentioned about the whole issue of delivery of health care in Pennsylvania, specifically the Affordable Care Act. But there are other issues that I'm concerned about that we need to look at. At the end of the day, folks are asking the question, what can they do? I think you need to stay diligent, review the issues, communicate with one another, communicate with both your state and federal officials to express your opinion on some of these issues, and get engaged in organizations that are working to either support or oppose what's being done in Washington. But this is an opportunity for folks to get involved in this process as we go forward. Finally, the other issue relates to our environment, again, in some ways related to what's taking place in Washington. I think, you know, we have to continue to do everything we can to protect our environment. I've been a long time supporter of many of the environmental measures that are in place in Pennsylvania, and we'll continue to support them. A couple folks are specifically asking about the impact of not only the DPW, but the EPA, and potentially the elimination. At the end of the day, I don't see that the EPA is going to go away. There may be some changes along those lines. I think it would be a major historical catastrophe if, in fact, we get on a path where we eliminate the EPA. It's a part of our agencies, of the federal government. They work with our DEP here in Pennsylvania, and we have to make certain that not only do we provide the appropriate level of resources to provide them the tools that they need to be safeguards or watchdogs in our environment, particularly in Pennsylvania, where we've got, for example, Marcellus and the like. So there's a number of those things that we have to look at as we go forward. But they have to have a strong voice. We just need to look at the city of Pittsburgh recently with the issue regarding our water. But for DEP's involvement and DEP being a part of that conversation, you know, there were some issues that developed there. If they're not there, they don't catch those issues. And at the end of the day, there's the level of quality of our water that we're drinking that could have been harmful. So I think they do a nice job. They do a good job. We don't have enough folks, quite frankly, there right now to do the inspecting and monitoring needs to be done. And we need to look to both the federal government and state government to provide those resources as well. So, Hugh, I'm ready to take a question.
All right,
I apologize for the long-winded answer.
Submitted questions. As a reminder, if you have a question for Senator Acosta this evening, press *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we're going to get our first caller tonight. He's Keith. Keith, go ahead. You're live with Senator Acosta.
Hi, Senator Acosta. My name is Keith.
Hi, Keith.
I live in Oakmont. I'm currently, I just was let go from the disability status because today's my birthday and I became 66 and that's my retirement age. And my benefits haven't really been affected because I have such a low income that, you know, I still am eligible for Medicaid and food stamps and things of that nature. But I'd rather go beyond that and be able to work and provide more for myself and to cover more of my expenses and be willing to pay for my insurance to some extent. But I feel locked in to some extent. I'm afraid to move ahead because I, you know, if I make another $50 from what I'm currently earning, I'll lose my Medicaid. So in order to, if I go out there and work part-time somewhere or do anything, I'm afraid that I'll lose my benefits, and it would be much difficult for me to reapply for them, I think, once I was let go from them. So is there anything I could do to persuade the government to go ahead and give some more of an extension for someone trying out to get back on their feet rather than staying under the guise of the state or the federal government supplying their income?
Thank you, Keith. First, let me wish you a happy birthday and hope you have many, many more as you go forward. You know, your question about what you can do in jeopardizing level of benefits that you might be receiving, specifically some Social Security benefits and any enhancement to that. I know we've taken steps here in Harrisburg on state benefits to try to prevent folks from being removed from the rolls. For example, and I believe it's the PACE and PACE-NET program, we discount certain levels of income and certain incomes to be able to allow more folks to be eligible. I think your point's well taken. I think folks who want to become sustainable and wean themselves off to some degree of some of the benefits that they're receiving is a laudable goal, and we should take steps to be able to try to facilitate that. And I think that's a great point you raise, and we will take a look at that.
There's a lot of fear involved in moving ahead because of losing what you may be eligible for now as opposed to what you'll have once you start working somewhere. So it doesn't pay for me to move forward to make do part-time work somewhere, because it'll cost me $500 more for my health insurance per month than what I'm already receiving.
Right.
So, I mean, is there any way that the government can calculate a way to be laudable and to move forward without, you know, being dependent on the system as opposed to being independent?
Right.
And that's the thing that I'd like to see move ahead on, something like that. And also, I know that they're even talking about with President Trump to go ahead and, you know, give each state X number of dollars to divide however they wish, which
right.
will probably reduce benefits either.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. On the Medicaid block grant that they're referring to, that would be very, very harmful to Pennsylvania and most other states. Because it creates issues with respect to how we drive out some of those resources and caps and limits what we're able to do. But on the point, Keith, about wanting to figure out a way to allow you to continue to do some want to work and go back to work and participate along those lines without jeopardizing your benefits, that's something we always try to calculate and try to work out a balance along those lines, and we're going to continue to be able to do that.
Keith, thank you very much. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Stephanie. Stephanie, go ahead. You're live with Senator Costa.
Hello, Senator Costa. This is Stephanie in Edgewood, and I'm really concerned about climate change, and I'm not seeing any initiative on the part of Pennsylvania government. It seems like instead climate change producing industries are being pushed, like the Shell cracker plant and increased fracking. And I'm wondering if there is any plan in place to reduce our emissions or support clean energy or take any steps to ensure that as climate change continues, because it's already started, that we will have clean water and air to breathe and drink and so forth.
I would say to you that there changes need to occur both at the state and federal level, and a number of changes have taken place through the EPA as it relates to the number of coal mines, for example, and their regulations along those lines. So changes have been made along those lines. At the state level, we continue to try to expand some of the things that we do with respect to alternative energy. I know that we have a lot of opportunities along those lines, particularly in southwestern Pennsylvania, to expand that. Unfortunately, we are in a Democratic minority, and it makes it difficult for our measures to be able to be advanced through the legislative process. That doesn't mean, though, we won't continue to fight and haven't been fighting to be able to try to advance those. A number of my colleagues have advanced legislation that would try to address that, and I think it's a good point that we have to figure out and work on. The governor made his proposal today. I don't believe that there was much conversation along those lines in his proposal today, but it doesn't mean that over the course of the next several months, next 2 months, as we begin to continue to work through his budget, that those conversations won't come up again.
Stephanie, thank you very much. If you have a question for Senator Costa, press *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Frank. Frank, go ahead. You're live with Senator Costa.
Hi, Senator. My name's Frank. I'm from Oakmont, and my question is, in order to reduce the state budget, my feeling, and I'm sure the millions of residents of Pennsylvania feel the same way, that first of all, we should reduce the number of crooks that we have in Harrisburg, and number two, that we should have mandatory term limits and not make it a lifetime career.
Thank you very much for your call. I don't agree with you that we have crooks here in Harrisburg. We've got a significant number of individuals who work very, very hard day in and day out, both here in Harrisburg and in our districts as well. That being said, I think that there are conversations about reducing the size of the House of Representatives, which I supported, and that measure will the second part of that constitutional amendment question will be part of the legislative process as we go forward over the next several months and early into this year that allow people to have the opportunity to say whether or not they want the legislature reduced or not. The second issue with respect to term limits, I would say to you that folks have the opportunity every 2 years and House members and every 4 years to have term limits. People have to go up for election every time along those lines. in areas where states that have provided term limits, the outcome has not always been what people had expected or wanted. At the end of the day, you do get different people in the elective office, but at the end of the day, what you end up is with high-level staff folks who end up becoming the folks who end up controlling government and running your government through the legislative process. That, to me, is not a good place to be. And as I mentioned, folks have the opportunity to cast their votes every couple of years. If you just look at this last election, for example, in our Senate districts, we had two members who served just one term and were removed from office because folks didn't support the level of what they did in the Senate side. And the House side, there were a number of other folks who were voted out of office. So the people of Pennsylvania have the opportunity to speak and determine whether or not they want that person to stay in office or not. That, to me, is what our founding fathers thought we should do with respect to how we elect folks.
Frank, thank you very much for your question. Senator, let's go back to the callers. We're going to go to Terry. Terry, go ahead. You're live with Senator Costa.
Hi, this is Terry in Pittsburgh. I have more a comment than a question. One is hang tough for Pennsylvania women on the access to abortion question. The fact that there's absolutely no discussion or debate with the public or medical personnel is really concerning. And the other thing that I wanted to say is how much I appreciate you having this town hall, because many of us who don't agree with the Republican agenda feel that our voices aren't being heard. We're writing letters, we're sending emails, we're trying to call, we're marching, and yet we're discounted as being outside agitators and all kinds of other names and ways to discredit a dissenting point of view. So I appreciate your ability to speak for those of us who believe in women's rights and environmental issues and other parts of the Democratic platform. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, you raise a great point as it relates to Senate Bill 3. You know, it's very disappointing. We've not had a public hearing on this issue in any part of the Commonwealth. In fact, tomorrow, Senator Judy Schwenk from Reading, Berks County, who's actually born and raised in Pittsburgh, Alma Rice graduate, it will be offering an amendment, to try to have the measure referred to our Health and Human Service Committee to allow for the opportunity to have hearings over the course of the next 5 weeks. When we will be doing our budget hearing. So that would be consistent with the work that we're doing now, having hearings on the budget. We think it's appropriate that we have hearings on this measure as well along those lines. With respect to our having these telephone town halls, we've been doing them over a year or so now. I think they're very important to allow folks to express their views on issues, but also ask questions of myself and the work that we're trying to do in Harrisburg. And so I appreciate the fact that you feel the way you do and all those lines, and I hope that you'll continue to participate not only in our process here tonight and other nights, but stay engaged and stay involved in this whole political process and conversation. I got to tell you, it's refreshing to hear so many folks who are writing and calling, filling out cards and the like, telling me where they stand on issues, because that's the way government's supposed to work.
Terry, thank you very much. That was a great question. Senator, we're going to go to John in Oakmont. John, go ahead. You're live with Senator Costa.
Senator Costa, this is John from Oakmont. I'm a local school director, and my question centers around the consideration of reducing the tax on residential properties and shifting the tax away from that. In doing so, I can appreciate that that has an appeal from the tax standpoint. My concern is from the school standpoint, an either intended or unintended consequence, when you shift, that would shift the money and the finance from the local level to the state level. And when you shift money, you also shift the power to manage the schools. And I think that local control has been very valuable. And my question is, in considering this shift in tax basis, how much discussion has there been on the issue of local control of education versus state level? And I could make this pointed by saying, given today Betsy DeVos was made the Cabinet Secretary of Education, I think people in the state might be glad that we control education at the state level than the federal level where the money is.
Thank you, John. You're right. I think I believe, like you do, that we all should be concerned about how education is going to be addressed at the federal level in light of the secretary's appointment and confirmation today. At the state level, the conversation around eliminating property taxes for school districts and imposing a sales tax, increasing the sales tax, expanding the base of the sales tax, as well as increasing the personal income tax by at least 1%, I believe, or close to 1%, presents many, many issues for myself and for others. But most importantly, you talk about the distribution side of the equation. The distribution and the decisions about how much money would make its way to a school district would be taken away from local school districts, invested into the state government to be able to do that. That is a concern that a lot of folks have as well. Local control, I think, in many instances is appropriate. We elect our local officials to make decisions for us. We, at the state level, should not always be dictating to local officials what they should be doing, nor should we be eliminating the authority for them to be able to do certain things. So there needs to be a very strong and significant conversation on property tax relief or elimination. That's precisely why Senate Democrats, we called for a special session on property tax to discuss these measures and to raise the points like you as a school board member just raised. I can tell you, I am hearing from dozens and dozens of school board members across Pennsylvania and in our own district that are very, very concerned about what we do with regard to the legislation that was enacted last term and will again be called Senate Bill 76. It sounds appealing. You're not going to pay your property taxes for the school districts, and it sounds great, particularly to our seniors. But at the end of the day, somebody else is going to be paying for, and there's another mechanism to pay for that nearly $11 billion that needs to be replaced around this Commonwealth. And at the end of the day, one of the things that has to happen is that by doing that, we have to relieve all of our commercial properties of the ability to have to pay their school taxes as well. So for some of those communities that have some of these large box stores and shopping malls and shopping centers and strip centers, those folks will no longer be paying property taxes to the tune of about $3 billion. And that $3 billion alone will be shifted away from those companies and entities and rental apartments and the like and shifted onto the backs of taxpayers across the Commonwealth. I don't think that's appropriate, and I do not support Senate Bill 76, and I've got grave concerns, particularly given some of the things that you talked about, not only on the tax side, but also on local control side. I don't know if I want, I don't know whether I should be making decisions as a legislator here in Harrisburg about school district issues that are taking place up in Erie or up in the northeastern part of the state. I think I would like to leave it to the folks who represent those areas, the school board members, to allow them to make the decisions what's best for their district, how they generate their revenue, and how it is they expend those revenues. Thank
John,
you very much.
John, thank you very much for your call. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Sigrid. Sigrid, go ahead. I hope I have that name right.
Hello.
Sigrid.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question. Why or how does a policeman without the registration stickers on our vehicles supposed to do his job? Now, I like to point out, I have no relations, no friends, or whatsoever with any kind of law enforcement. Now, this man sits in a squat in a car. He has to drive. He has to look out for probably unregistered or uninsured vehicles. How does a man supposed to do that, or a woman, whatever? That is one thing I can't understand. Our law enforcement, they're not computers and programmed to look and know what's going on.
I agree with your concern about the registration sticker. I supported the measure to not repeal the stickers. I think that the dollars that were saved on balance, that when you look to the amount of opportunities our law enforcement community has, I think when you balance the two out, I think it would have been a wise investment to continue to have the registration stickers to allow our law enforcement personnel the ability to do what they need to do. So I was disappointed that provision went into effect. That being said, PennDOT has indicated that they will provide to local municipal police agencies what are called license plate readers, that they would be able to easily pull up to somebody and look at the license plate and very quickly ascertain whether or not that vehicle is registered. Again, diminishing the value of the savings that were attributed to getting rid of the sticker. So, but at the end of the day, it's here, and we've got to recognize that, and we have to do more to protect and help our law enforcement officials by providing them the resources to be able to go and assist them in purchasing some of the equipment that they need to be able to do this particular role in a more efficient way.
Sigrid, thank you very much for your question. Senator, just as a reminder, if people have questions about that, a question for Senator Costa tonight, you press star 3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Roy in Pittsburgh. Roy, go ahead. You're live with Senator Costa.
Yes, hello. This is Roy in Pittsburgh, and I also want to thank you for having this town hall and for encouraging citizens to contact you and get some answers. So, first of all, I was reading about a Senate bill that is being co-sponsored by Lisa Buscola and Mario Scavello and concerning redistricting. And I was wondering what your feeling about that was and whether you would consider co-sponsoring it as well.
So the redistricting issue has been an issue for a number of years. With respect to that process, I mean, I served as Democratic leader, and I sat on the Reapportionment Commission and, quite frankly, was the only dissenting vote for the maps that came forward through that process. And I took the first map that was done by primarily by Republican colleagues to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and along with Amanda Holt, were successful in having that map thrown out. At the end of the day, what we ended up with was nearly a 60-page opinion from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that has really changed the way in which the commission would operate as we go forward. Now, there are two schools of thoughts on what we need to do with redistricting. There are some people who believe that we should look to the Buscola legislation and put together a citizens commission, and that would be one of the issues. Some of the pushback on that has been the composition of this commission. The composition of the commission, while it sounds as if it would be done by in an impartial way, so many Republicans, so many Democrats, so many independents and the like, the fact of the matter is the manner in which that legislation dictates would be that the Pennsylvania Secretary of State, an appointee of governor, the sitting governor, would be the person who determines all the appointees. So, for example, one of the concerns that I hear from a lot of folks is that they're not necessarily sure they want the Secretary of State to be picking the Republican members if it was a Democratic governor. So that becomes one of the issues, that while folks believe that the impartiality is there, the fact of the matter is there's some who believe that it would not be gone and you would end up with individuals being selected on the opposite party by an individual who is of another party. That's a major concern for a lot of folks. The other issue relates to, there's a school of thought that folks say that, you know, we have a new Supreme Court decision, 60-some pages, that provides a lot of guidance and a lot of direction about what we can and can't do with respect to the issues of gerrymandering only in the state districts, the state legislative districts, and that what took place last year was because we had a individual who was selected as the chairman by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that was very biased towards Republicans, and every decision was made after he consulted with the Republicans and not the Democrats. That was wrong. That's what was part of the problem with respect to that process last time. There's some who believe that with a new Supreme Court in place and that you will not end up with a person who is so partisan along those lines, and I think that would be helpful. So that combined with the new legislation, with the new court opinion that we didn't have the last two times, would allow us the opportunity to have a more balanced and fair plan. Now, on the state legislative side, the congressional seats, those are done entirely different. Legislative seats and for Congress are done through legislation. So what we had back in 2010 was we had a Republican governor, a Republican Senate, and a Republican House. And they ran through a congressional redistricting map that looks the way it looks. And if you look at, particularly in the western part of the state, Tim Murphy's district runs from snakes across four or five counties. Keith Roth's district starts, I think, in Johnstown and makes its way over to almost into Beaver and Butler counties and across the top of Allegheny. Those were districts that were drawn by Republicans, rubber stamped by Republicans, and shoved down the throats of the people of Pennsylvania and this country. That process is wrong. That process, I believe, should be looked to possibly having the same legislative reapportionment type process that we have in place in Pennsylvania. Because, God forbid, 2 years from now, we have another Democrat, if we have a Republican governor, given their Republican majorities in the Senate and the House, we'll end up with another 10 years, if not longer, baked in congressional districts that favor Republicans by 13-5 margin. That's wrong. We need to have balance. At the end of the day, we should have 6 D ones based on population, 6 R's, and 6 that are up for grabs. And we don't have that now. We have 13-5, and it'll be 13-5 in perpetuity unless things change. So those are the two schools of thoughts. I don't know whether or not we're going to be entertaining either one of those bills anytime soon as we go forward, but we have at least a year and a half yet to go because the measure would be a constitutional amendment and to see where people need to feel on that issue. I hope I explained it. And that was one of the other calls that we got from somebody earlier today, a couple emails from folks along those lines, and I hope that addressed the concerns.
Roy, Roy, thank you very much. Very good question. If you have a question for Senator Costa, press *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we're going to go to Carol in Braddock Hills. Carol, go ahead. You're live with Senator Costa.
Yes. Hi, Senator Costa. Pleased to be speaking with you. My question was when you wanted the new department that was becoming a Department of Health and Human Services and you were combining 4 departments, and the gentleman did give me 3 of the departments that you planned on combining. One was the health and human drugs, and right. What were the 4 departments anyway?
So the 4 departments would be we used to call the old Department of Welfare is now called Department of Human Services. So Human Services, Department of Health, Department of Aging, and the Department of Drug and Alcohol. Those 4 have been operating, in my view, and sort of as individual silos, each providing services within their jurisdiction. The understanding would be, and we'll discuss this over the course of the next several weeks through our budget process, determine whether or not it's feasible or whether or not it makes sense and how we would want to go about implementing it. But we would create one new agency that would provide those services that each of those agencies provided. It provides for a lot more efficiencies. Folks aren't having, a lot of times, the same folks are accessing the same type of services, whether it be health or welfare or health, human services, or even aging. Folks go back and forth into those agencies. And each time we shouldn't be recreating the wheel to be able to try to do that. So this is an attempt to streamline government and also be able to enhance the level of services that we provide. I think it makes sense. I think we ought to take a look at it. But we also got to be careful that we don't make it too unwieldy and that folks are able to deliver the services that we need to deliver in Pennsylvania. The other part of it is it's going to be able to save us some resources. There's no will in Harrisburg to raise PIT or sales tax. So oftentimes you have no choice but to be able to think outside the box, streamline what you do, and cut your spending along those lines. And that's what this will allow to take place.
Carol, thank you very much for your call. Senator, we're going to back to the call. We're going to go to Cherelle. Cherelle, go ahead. You're live with Senator Costa.
Good evening, Senator. I'm calling from Pittsburgh. I have a question, or I would like to hear your thoughts. I have concerns about keeping mental health funding as it is, or not, at least not decreasing the funding. I also would like to hear what your thoughts are as about parity with mental health and medical health, as well as medication assistance for the treatment of medications for the treatment of opiate addiction. I think these are all really important areas of mental health, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on them.
Thank you very much. I served for a period of time as the chairman of Bank and Insurance and that when we did the Mental Health Parity Act, and I think we have to do more along those lines and work harder to be able to achieve true parity along those lines. With respect to the medical or medicine supported or delivery of the services we provide along the lines of the type of treatment somebody gets, I think we have to explore every option we have available to us. We're in the midst of a crisis, and we need to address along those lines. I also share your concern about the not only mental health program dollars, but all program dollars that make their way through Health and Human Services that are providing for community services or community services in the community that folks provide, the local providers. We've got to be able to give them the resources and the tools to be able to provide the services in the community. Otherwise, when you start to eliminate them, you end up in a situation where folks the budget cuts and the like end up manifesting themselves in other issues that are taking place in our local community, as we've seen in a number of areas. So we're going to make certain as we go through this budget process that we preserve the level of funding for these agencies, that they don't get scooped up into other areas, and that we don't put too many restrictions on how we deliver those services. But we have to do what we can to be able to do that. On the opioid crisis, that's a major crisis we have to deal with. I've been proposing, in fact, this week I've introduced legislation that would provide for those individuals who have family members or family members who have children or spouses or somebody in their family that they want to get into a treatment facility but have no opportunity to do so because the individual who may be suffering from the addiction, whether it be alcohol or drugs, doesn't want to go. We're creating what I would call what's called Casey's Law in some other states that provides for an involuntary commitment process. I've known a number of folks that have come to me and said, my child needs help. I want to try to get my child help, but I've got no mechanism to force him to go and get the treatment that he or she needs. This legislation would allow for that mechanism for folks who have insurance to be able to do that, to force that person through the court process and through a hearing process to get them into a facility. The second thing I'm working on relates to looking to the pharmaceutical companies to be part of the solution. I really believe that they are, in part, one of the reasons why we're dealing with this whole opioid crisis, and I think that they have an obligation to all of us to be able to be part of a solution, particularly as it relates to driving out resources that would allow us to be able to do treatment, making more treatment space available, whether it be beds or treatment programs, making more of them available. So we would look to have them be a part of it through an assessment, a temporary assessment, to allow them to be able to help us establish the treatment levels we need. So in one track we'll go down, we'll relate to those individuals who need treatment to help family members help get that particular person into the treatment that they need. But we have to make sure we have the treatment facilities and beds available for that treatment. And that's the second path we're going to work down as we go forward.
Cheryl, thank you very much for your question. If you have a question for Senator Costa, press *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we're going to go to Beth. Beth, go ahead. You're live with Senator Costa.
Hi, Senator Costa. I'm from Pittsburgh, and thank you so much for having this town hall and for all your service. Myself and a lot of other women across the state are very concerned about Senate Bill 3, and we are aware that it will probably pass the House and the Senate and be vetoed by Governor Wolf. My question for you is, what is the realistic likelihood of an override of that veto, and what can we as concerned citizens of Pennsylvania do to help in that cause? Thank you.
Thank you. It's likely to pass the Senate. I believe there may be just one Democratic vote along those lines, but I think there'll be more Republican votes, a handful of Republican votes against it, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong, but at least I know maybe one, if not any, Democrats would vote to support it. House, I'm not sure what the outcome will be, but the governor has indicated he will be vetoing the legislation, which raises the question why we're going through this process to begin with, but that's another matter. But at the end of the day, I believe that we will be able to sustain the governor's veto. I believe that there'll be sufficient number of Democrats and Republicans coming together to do that. What can be done? I think if folks are opposed to this legislation, I think it's imperative that they contact their legislators, both in the House and the Senate, regardless of where you live, and encourage them to vote no on the legislation if that's what they want to do, or vote yes if that's their position, but more importantly, to do what they can to sustain the governor's veto. And I think that's what needs to be done. Folks need to let legislators know how they feel about any issue and take steps to communicate with them directly, whether it be a phone call, whether it be an email, whether it be a handwritten letter explaining why one feels a particular way would be the appropriate way to do it. But I do think that that's a very, very important issue.
Beth, thank you very much. Senator, we're going to go to George. George in Wilkinsburg. George, go ahead. You're live with Senator Costa.
Good evening, Mr. Costa.
Good evening, George.
I'd like to start off by thanking you personally as an American citizen. I think you're doing a great service to our fellow Americans by providing this forum because I think we are on the verge of losing our democratic institutions. Where we, of all the Western nations, we have one of the fewest number of people who participate in every election, and you're doing something I hope can be a modern impetus for people to get back in the process of believing in our system and voting that. And so now I'll bring up my issue to you, the reason I called this evening. My issue is, it's not an issue, it's a minor concern to some of the people, previous callers, because they're talking very serious stuff. I had the pleasure of meeting you on October the 6th on a beautiful sunshine blue sky day down Wilkinsburg, where you are a supporter of the railroad station restoration.
Yes, the train station restoration, yep.
That is right. And what I'm asking today, if you can give any kind of like update, you see, though this issue I'm bringing up to you, I recognize it's not of some of these major outer issues that the previous callers called in, but it's of the highest importance to Wilkesburg residents. We're like a lot of communities in the western Pennsylvania, across the Midwest, who we have, last 50 years, we've seen a lot of economic decline by plan, the jobs being shipped overseas, no more dignity, no more jobs with decent wages and pensions. And the railroad station, to me, is like a modern-day phoenix rising from the ashes. It can be a rally point for all the people in the community to bring people together and forget about divisions of gender, race, age group, what have you. And that's why it's of a high importance to the Wilkesburg residents that I talk to, and I'm proud to say that there's a lot of people who feel this way. They're putting aside our differences, and this is like a point where we have to start somewhere.
Yep. So thank you very much. That's a great point. You know, so many of our folks who live in our communities have great pride in their community, and I can sense from talking to people in Wilkinsburg that train station, what that represented to a lot of folks, and what it's a symbol of lately have been of decay that needs to be addressed. So I'm very proud to be part of the working group that's bringing resources back to the train station to help renovate it, along with a number of other folks. The Wilkinsburg Economic Development, CDC, and others have put together a task force working on it. I am convening a meeting with Congressman Doyle. We don't have a specific date. We're trying to work out a specific date with bringing Congressman Doyle, Representative Ganey, and a few other folks together to do two things. One, an update, and number two, to figure out what we need to do to bring closure to the funding that's needed to be able to get it moving. But I think once completed, once the restoration occurs, it serves as a catalyst to the community, particularly the business district there, that things are moving in the right direction. And there are a number of things that are going on in the community and where folks have great pride. And pride in your community and your neighborhood comes in a variety of ways. I would tell you, just today, we had the Westinghouse football team up here. As you know, and maybe all of our listeners, readers, or folks participating don't know, we have had a very successful Knockwood merger of the Wilkinsburg and Westinghouse High School. And the students on that team were from both communities. And they were city champs, and they participated in a state playoff. And it was great pride. When we met with the governor today, we talked about that, encouraging the kids to continue to do well and perform well, both athletically, but more importantly, academically, has been the case. So, and just yesterday, we had the state champs from Still Valley High School here up in the Capitol, spent some time doing some different things together. But the communities of Homestead and West Homestead and Munn Hall, again, have great pride in their communities, and those are the type of things that we have to be able to do. So restoring a train station or supporting our programs in our school districts, that's the stuff that I think brings pride to our community and helps us revitalize. And that's what we have to do. We have to make investments along those lines. Last couple of years, statewide, we've not been as going it appropriately, but I'm pleased to tell you in Wilkinsburg, I'm working closely with your council and the mayor. We've been driving out significant dollars along the lines of demolition work that's being done, particularly along Ardmore and Penn Avenue there. We're also doing some multimodal resources that are working to redirect the traffic flow in some of the communities off of Penn Avenue, and we're doing a few other things there as well. So we're not done working there, but the goal is to try to drive resources to assist in revitalizing some of these communities. I would tell you the county, Allegheny County, through Rich Fitzgerald and Economic Development Director Hurley, are working very hard to do some things along the 800 block of Penn Avenue. There's a lot of conversations going on to revitalize those communities. Wilkinsburg is just one example, and we look forward to working with them as we go forward. So thank you very much for that call.
George, thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Joan. Joan, go ahead. You're live with Senator Costa.
Hi, Senator. Hi, Senator Costa. This is Joan from Munhall. First of all, I'd like to applaud you for not attending Trump's inauguration, and second, also for the staff at Homestead and Fox Chapel that I'm sorry, Forest Hills that I've had to use for services. They've been very, very efficient and helpful. My question to you is, though, regarding prescription drug coverage, the escalating cost, we as residents of Pennsylvania, where can we go, how do we go about addressing, approaching these pharmaceutical companies? I had one incident today. I had been buying a medication. I paid $12. It went to $55.69. I contacted my insurance carriers. They said, yes, there's nothing they can do. They go from a Tier 1 to a Tier 3. They can automatically do that. What can we as citizens do? Where do we start?
Well, I think you can start by contacting our office, and we can put you in touch with the consumer advocate and making certain that we work along those lines. If it's an insurance matter, we can also put you in touch with the insurance department and indicate to them that by filing an insurance complaint form. And then what we can do is walk with you through those processes to assist you to try to find out exactly why these things are taking place. And then the second question is, what do we need to do as legislators to try to prevent that from happening? I've got a major concern for the manner in which some of our insurance companies have been working over the course of the past several years. And again, back in the opioid conversation, I got very concerned about the limitation that they provide on the level of treatment that's provided, and oftentimes, sometimes I should say, the misleading nature of some of the benefits that one might have to be able to provide treatment. I think we need to bring greater clarity. To that end, I've written to the Commissioner of Insurance asking that we take a look at that particular issue to make certain that these organizations and entities that have these employee manuals that describe the level of benefits that one to receive, there needs to be more clarity about specifically what is offered to those employees and what they're entitled to. But to go back to your question, yes, I think what can be done is contact my office, whether it be Forest Hills or the Homestead office, and then we'll work with you along those lines to be able to get those insurance complaints into the commissioner's office and also looking to contact the consumer's advocate.
Joan, thank you very much for the question. Senator, we're going to go to Faye in Penn Hills. Faye, go ahead. You're live with Senator Costa.
Yes, Senator Costa, am I speaking with you now?
Yes, you are, Faye.
Okay, I apologize because I stepped away, actually. I was kind of waiting, and then I didn't get a heads up, so I had my hand in dishwater. anyway, I heard another person who called in say she was glad that you didn't attend the inauguration, and I'll conversely say I'm saddened that you did not, but I'll just lay it down right there. The reason that I was calling is that I reside in Penn Hills. I have for almost 30 years, and I continue to be increasingly concerned, actually to the point where I'm looking at moving out of the community because of the increase in taxes, because of the increase in water and sewage. I just learned that when I went to pay my bill that we now pay 34% more this year for sewage, and I had been told whenever I sought an audience at the Wilkinsburg-Penjoy Water Authority that we would not be impacted because we've had this fine on us for so many years. Actually, in fact, I think all the years I've lived here, I've had the opportunity, you know, to pay increasingly more and more for, you know, this utility that actually is more than my gas. Praise God that gas went down in price in this past year. So, you know, now the water and sewage comes in to take whatever tiny dollars might be left out of my budget. So, you know, I'm, you know, and I know this concern of infrastructure related to water and sewage exceeds the community I live in. And I had attended those meetings that Alcosan was hosting when they were talking about the wet weather project that would come to this region to take, you know, to put infrastructure, you know, from communities to take rainwater down to the rivers. And if I am remembering correctly, that project was to cost the residents of 83 communities between $2.5 and $3.6 billion, and that EPA-mandated project was not having one tax dollar at either the state or federal level applied to it. And I have to say, I don't know what the status of that is at the moment, but that's just some of my concerns.
So on that particular issue, you're correct. The EPA has driven a directive down to us on the Elkosan, the 83 communities, that we need to fix our sewer infrastructure. We've got very, very serious issues that I think harm and jeopardize the environmental situation we have here in our county, and these are things that need to be done. There's, as it relates to the cost associated with it, I know that they're trying to scale back the cost, and the EPA has been very helpful in sort of postponing the need to be able to do that. But the longer we postpone it, however, so that we can look at the green infrastructure conversation and the like. However, the longer we delay it, the more expensive it may become. But we can't put our head in the sand and think that we don't have infrastructure problems with our water and sewer. We've got lines on the water side that are lead-based lines that need to be changed, and we've got sewer systems that are backing up and creating havoc into our streams and our rivers and the like. So we have to address it. I will say to you, though, that I think that the funding side of the equation needs to be further vetted out. I don't think that local communities need to bear the degree that they would, but also the state government and federal government need to participate along those lines as well. But the problem that we're in is because for decades and decades, folks did put their head in the sand, particularly local municipal officials and others, put their head in the sand and didn't want to deal with the issue because nobody saw it. It was underground. And now we have to hold our, hold ourselves. We have to be held accountable for things that we haven't done and moving forward. And that's part of the issue that we have to deal with. We have an old age infrastructure system, and we have to make investments and changes to it, and I think that's what's going to happen. I wish I could tell you otherwise. I know the Penn Hills went through the consent decree a number of years ago, and folks have been paying for years on that, whether it was $25 or $30 for a lot of years every time. Unfortunately, that is an issue that's not going to go away, and I think EPA is going to hold us to that. DEP, our state agency, has been trying to work with them to try to mitigate that as much as we can, as well as Elkosan, but we've got more work to do along those lines.
Senator, I know we're coming down the home stretch. Give some concluding comments for the folks that have joined us this evening.
Yes, it looks like we have about 12 or so more questions in the queue, and unfortunately we're not going to get to them. So what we will do is take an opportunity to talk to folks, capture the questions that we've not answered, and then communicate back with folks either in the form of a letter or an email, so that if you want to do that, leave your name and number and the like, an email address with our folks. But at the end of the day, I want to say thanks, everyone. We're able to do these again. My particular election time is over, so I anticipate to do these at least two or three more times over the course of the next year. But we also wanted to make sure we communicated back with folks about the governor's budget address. I anticipate that we'll be doing other community events along those lines, and look forward to having folks participate as we go forward. So thank everyone. It's a privilege and honor for me to serve and represent the communities of the 43rd District. It's something that I hold holds a very significant place with me, and it's an honor to be entrusted with that ability to do so. So thanks, everyone, for participating, and look forward to either seeing you in the community or touching base with you through either letter or phone call or an email as we go forward. Thank you, and have a good night.
Senator Costa indicated if you didn't have a chance to ask your question, please remain in the line. You'll be able to leave your question on a voicemail, and Senator Costa and his staff will get back to you. If you have any additional questions or concerns, you can call the Senator's office at 412-241-6690 or visit his website at senatorcosta.com. Thank you for a pleasant conversation. Have a good evening.
Thank you.